These are my comments from the passage from 153 to 155 that I just read, where Gunnar goes to El Campesino Real. The passage in which Gunnar introduces the reader into the rich, whitewashed world of El Campesino Real was especially compelling to me because it shows that although Gunnar has an incredibly perceptive and skeptical view of both the white disease of supremaciosis and the position of the black captives at the school, he has not entirely transcended either of those boundaries. He is very much in limbo, an outsider wherever he goes, no matter how hard he tries to blend in. He admits that he is envious of the self-loving white aristocrats, while he realizes that their treatment of the black kids is ignorant and most likely a product of suburban, semi-segregated upbringing. He is humiliated at the waxen behavior of his black classmates, who resort to performing soul shakes and playing football in order to entertain the vicious but appeasable teen supremacists. Yet he follows the fold and executes his self-berating vaudeville-style moves for the almost Nazi-like throng of socialites and BMOCs. Even his mother is intrigued by the Valley bon vivants, most likely because riding on their tails, however defeatist it might be, would probably guarantee a more pampered life devoid of the danger and gang violence rampant in Gunnar's hillside hangouts, which actually brings up another interesting point. In this scene, Scobie and Psycho Loco are seen from a distance, calling out to Gunnar as he leaves behind his much more perilous but somehow more liberating stomping grounds in the hood. The reader roots for the troublemaking duo as they yell out, "Stay black!" and Scobie warns Gunnar to be himself and to not get sucked into the white world. However, even a scene like this is problematic. Is staying black really equivalent to stealing safes, shooting at street signs, and going to so many funerals that one has memorized every passage in the church service? It is not fair to pigeonhole the black identity in such a negative gangster light. Where, then, does Gunnar fit? He may be doomed to stay an outsider forever in any community, black, white, or mixed. Yet, if Gunnar was to lose his outsider position and enter the center, he would most likely lose his sarcastic edge. Even a throwaway phrase like, "it was like swimming," has an edgy and relevant subtext. It is easy for Gunnar to catch on to the white affluent language, the raised octaves, hardened R's, and diphthong vowels, just as it is easy for the average person to wade around in water. However, the water is no place for a human being to live, and once one remains in a pool or an ocean too long, one becomes uncomfortable, and the conditions of the water begin to feel unnatural. This subtle opener for the much more obvious punchline of, "Dude, man, no way," suggests that, although Gunnar absent-mindedly mimics even the hair tosses of the rich white kids, he knows that this station in his long journey is not, and should not be, a permanent one. Language and dialect in this section play a huge role in the reader's understanding of both the humor of the passage and the pathetic nature of the white kids and the kowtowing black kids. The idea that Raymond is a supposed black name and Kelly a supposed white name seems foolish at first. How could a name be white or black? But in mainstream culture, it is true that names like Kelly and Megan have become whitewashed. The joke still registers as a joke, but the fact that we laugh by association proves that America's racializing of names is real. The Monty Python reference, which paints white rich kids as way overly anglicized, is hilarious, especially in the way Beatty meticulously writes out phonetic translations of the Cockney speak so that we may do our own impression. Even the simple, "hey guy," that Gunnar says on page 155 paints such a clear picture of the preppy, overprivileged Caucasian crew. The reader also laughs, albeit reluctantly, when the black students play dumb and speak with poor pronunciation and grammar. We know they are spoofing a stereotype of their own people, but it is truly sad that they have to stoop so low and demean themselves just to be accepted in this specific setting. In addition to the zingers and messages embedded in the language, I was also intrigued by Gunnar's tone. His delivery of the fake prosaic commandments of domesticity drips with italicized disgust, which to the reader is entirely understandable. I could feel his frustration and rage as he tested Danny Kraft on countries, only to find that Danny did not know all of the capitals. Rather, the capitals of safe non-third world countries with mostly non-black natives. I personally find the popular catchphrase "limousine liberal" offensive, but in this case, I believe Beatty is making a comment about the white upper class's knowledge of world issues and their true investment in charitable causes. Kids like Danny Kraft appear to not have been taught the real ways of the world. Their reality, is a bubble in which everyone is comfortable and happy. Their rah-rah jingoism is really a sort of isolationism, where they are blind to any issues that they do not understand or cannot relate to. Although this passage is meant to exaggerate the description of the specific social group, I was shocked to realize that I know people like Danny Kraft, which is a problem. Thus, I'm now a true believer in satire. The best way into my heart as a reader is always through laughter, and the laugh-then-cry effect of satire really does get at relevant and serious material without being too in-your-face and overly radical. The fact that the works of many satirists are out of print is so disappointing, because I believe if more readers could laugh at their flaws through satire, they might more readily realize and accept flaws in themselves and society.